From the studios of WRPI in Troy, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, what happens when you mix the two, and like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and the music is too loud. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host for the next 2 hours as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode 9 of Little Brother, dated 8th of June, 2001. Stay tuned, Little Brother's right around the corner. Okay, well, I think I've got my brain put together here, so let's give this thing a shot. The opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants, not necessarily those of the WRPI staff or management, the RPI Student Union, or Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. If you'd like to give us a call with your opinions and your views, I'd love to hear from you. The phone number here at WRPI Studios is area code 518-276-6248. That number again, area code 518-276-6248. So let's get started. First item we have here is from the Risks Digest. The recording industry may be hoist on its own petard if the Napster-like music swapping service called Aimster is successful in its legal strategy against the Recording Industry Association of America, or RIAA. Unlike Napster, Aimster, which has no central servers to maintain and leaves users individually responsible for their actions, encrypts transmissions, and so there's no way for the RIAA or any other outside party to distinguish between files which are in compliance with copyright law and those which infringe on it. Of course, the RIAA could simply decrypt the files, but then it would be in violation of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, a law which it strongly supports and which makes it a criminal offense to circumvent encryption protection of copyrighted material. Isn't that a beaut? Here's one for to kind of twist your brain up into tight little knots. This one was actually put out by Keith F. Lynch. He says, warning, do not calculate pi in binary. It is conjectured that this number is normal, meaning that it contains all finite bit strings. If you compute it, you will be guilty of copyright infringement of all books, all short stories, all newspapers, all magazines, all websites, all music, all movies, and all software, including the complete Windows source code. Trademark infringement, possession of child pornography, espionage, unauthorized possession of top-secret information, possession of DVD-cracking software, possession of threats to the president, possession of everybody's social security number, everybody's credit card numbers, everybody's PIN numbers, everybody's unlisted phone numbers, and everybody's passwords. Defaming Islam, not technically illegal, but you have to go into hiding along with Salman Rushdie, and defaming Scientology, which is illegal, just ask Keith Henson. Also, your computer will contain all of the nastiest known computer viruses. In fact, all of the nastiest possible computer viruses. Some of the files on my PC are intensely personal, and I, for one, don't want you snooping through a copy of them either. You might get away with computing just a few digits, but why risk it? There's no telling how far into Pi you can go without finding the secret documents about the JFK assassination, a photograph of your neighbor's six-year-old doing the nasty with a family dog, or a complete copy of the Pearl Harbor movie. So just don't do it. The same warning applies to E, the square root of 2, Euler's constant, phi, the cosine of any non-zero algebraic number, and the vast majority of all other real numbers. There's a reason why these numbers are always computed and shown in decimal, after all. Now, although this one's not strictly computer relevant, this case is nonetheless noteworthy. This regards the Wind Done Gone, which was a spoof of Gone with the Wind, written from the point of view of a black slave. At any rate, a U.S. appeals court in Atlanta overturned a lower court ruling that Margaret Mitchell's estate could block the publication of this parody. And good news for freedom of speech there. The Federal Bureau of Investigation has, in the past 10 days, charged 88 individuals with internet crimes, including wire and mail fraud and money laundering. A government prosecutor said internet fraud, whether it's in the form of securities and other investment schemes, online auction and merchandising schemes, credit card fraud, identity theft, etc., has become one of the fastest growing and most pervasive forms of white collar crime. That comes to us from the Bloomberg News via the Washington Post. When Richard Smith, Privacy Foundation's CTO, obtained his FBI file from Choice Point in Georgia, he discovered that he had died in 1976 and had had aliases with Texas convicts known as Ricky or Ricky. Well, two different spellings, one with a Y, one with an IE. This is apparently the kind of information that the FBI now depends on. In 1998, a Chicago woman with no criminal record was fired after Choice Point Info mistakenly indicated that she was a shoplifter and convicted drug dealer. Choice Point Info was also involved in the thousands of Floridians being mistakenly identified as felons and disenfranchised in the November 2000 election. Choice Point blames that data on a data aggregator, DBT. According to an article in The Register, the Council of the European Union is considering implementing rules that call for storing of all telecommunications traffic, that is, all phone calls, all net usage, and every email, and making this data accessible for at least 7 years. This will be done in the name of, quote, public safety and law enforcement, no doubt. Technical considerations aside, i.e. the concept of server farms the size of France come to mind, the whole thing is just a dreadful idea. The website of the federally funded Computer Emergency Response Team was clogged by a denial-of-service attack that lasted 30 hours a week ago. CERT, which is located at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, has a mission of providing warnings about computer attacks and viri. An official of the organization said, "We get attacked every day. This is just another attack. The lesson to be learned here is that no one is immune to these kinds of attacks. They cause operational problems, and it takes time to deal with them." The FAA recently put up an airport traffic website at www.fly.faa.gov where you can check out conditions at any airport. Well, recently they added the option to get email on airport conditions, with a warning to be careful not to select all airports, as that would be a dreadful lot of mail. Now, the way this works is you put in an email address and a password. This is the password to make changes on the FAA's site. They then ask you what airports and how many characters your emailer can handle. Having selected DTW for days, you'll get no email. This morning, this was actually May 15th, and this is Robert Moskowitz is reporting this, by the way. He'd already gotten three messages about various delays due to different thunderstorms. So, if somebody doesn't like somebody else, they just set up the system to mail bomb the other person's cell phone. Imagine how annoying it will be with a phone constantly going off and not knowing how to stop the mail. Would most people figure out how to get this stopped? I've not contacted my cellular provider on how to stop SMS spam, so I doubt if there's much experience there, but there will be probably before the year is done. Oh, this one's a beaut. And in particular, I'm actually hoping that the caller I had around the turn of the hour last show, about 2 weeks ago, is listening for this one, because this is a beaut. In Office XP, the link you type is not what you get. What will happen in this particular case, let's take, for example, you're in Office XP, you choose insert hyperlink, and you can type in this hyperlink. http://www.fred.com/trial/2345/. When you hit enter, the double slash, not the first one, the second one, is unceremoniously converted to a single slash. You aren't notified. You aren't given a chance to change it. In fact, with one exception, you can't even override the ham-handed mangling of your carefully constructed hyperlink. The exception is in front page 2002, you can fix the link by going into HTML mode and overtyping, but there's no such option in Word, Excel, PowerPoint, or Outlook. Even Microsoft can't suggest a workaround. It's even worse than you might imagine. The text appears in the document the way you typed it. That is, you'll see http://www.fred.com/trials/2345 in your document. But the link itself, the part behind the scenes that controls where you really go when you click on the text, is altered without any notice. Don't believe me? Follow these instructions, then right-click on the hot text and pick Edit Hyperlink. Look in the address box. See it? While a double slash is unusual, it is a valid hyperlink used in the real world. Most commonly as a delimiter between parameters. Microsoft has no right to arbitrarily change a link that I've typed, especially if there's no way to override the change. Putting this problem to Microsoft's PR folks with a series of questions to help clarify the situation, their response was amongst the most arrogant and obfuscatory that we've seen in many years of dealing with the company. A dismissive response not designed to help or reassure prospective Office XP purchasers. In fact, it's only made a bad situation worse. Microsoft says it's not an issue at all. The change is done intentionally for, you gotta love this, cleanliness and consistency. Apparently, the accuracy of a hyperlink is secondary to it looking nice. Microsoft dismisses the double slash change problem, saying that they don't know of any servers which deal with a double slash in the path component anyway other than to treat it as a single slash. Come on, call 1-800-GET-A-CLUE, guys. Double slashes are used all the time. More than that, it isn't Microsoft's job to decide whether the URLs I type are politically correct. Microsoft goes on to say that some older servers did not like to have the double slashes in the path and had difficulties with double slashes. Well, okay, that may be true, but there are plenty of other typing errors that I can make to break a link. Double slashes may be a problem in some cases, but in others, they are necessary. Of course, the beaut was when the Microsoft, he said, we don't change the parameter data, only the path part of the URL. Good grief. If this comes from a company that assures everyone uses the Microsoft method of passing information through links. In the Microsoft world, you pass the data to a web page by adding a question mark at the end of the link, and then adding the variables. Incredibly, not everyone uses Microsoft servers, and there are other ways to pass information through a web link. One of the ways we found includes double slashes. Microsoft Office XP now blocks those uses with no recourse. Now, even if you accept the logic that double slashes and hyperlinks are non-existent or bad, that doesn't change the more general principle that Microsoft wants to make a change for cleanliness and consistency. They should build a warning in to make to the user and a way to reverse the change. A smart tag would work nicely, but in this case, neither of these basic design courtesies is honored. The company has gone too far in compulsory changes in the link with no warning to the user or any workaround to fix the autocorrect. Adding insult to injury, or injury to insult, whichever way you want to look at it, there's no documentation on these changes in the help file. Microsoft has declined to provide details of any other compulsory changes made to hyperlinks in Office XP, nor have they suggested any workaround for those affected, or some way to switch off this behavior. The Microsoft arrogance shows through. It's not a problem, so why bother fixing it? If you would like to add your opinions at this point, please feel free to call. The number here at WRPI is area code 518-276-6248. Sacrifice. The station is WRPI Troy. The show is Little Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter. Topic is technology. This next item comes to us from Computer World. An investigative committee on the European Parliament has concluded that the U.S. National Security Agency, along with the intelligence services of four other countries, operate a global electronic surveillance network codenamed Echelon, but that the system is far less capable than previously reported. A May 18th draft report by the European Parliament's temporary committee on the Echelon interception system concludes that while the existence of the system is no longer in doubt, analysis shows that it cannot be nearly as extensive as some sections of the media have assumed. Still, the committee urged European Union member states, businesses, and private citizens to use encryption software whenever possible. The report, which is scheduled to be presented in full in Parliament on September 4th, is the latest in a series of reports spanning 4 years that have looked into claims of industrial espionage and civil liberties violations stemming from the Echelon system, run by the Australia, Canada, New Zealand, UK, and US. Echelon is believed to be capable of capturing the vast majority of telephone, fax, email, and radio communications around the globe for the purpose of being analyzed by the intelligence services of the nations that run it. To date, officials in the U.S. have publicly disavowed any knowledge of the Echelon system. However, in a significant reversal of the hyperbole that has surrounded much of the debate about Echelon, the EU report concludes that the majority of the communications cannot be intercepted by Earth stations, but only by tapping cables and intercepting radio signals. The report goes on to state that the five countries responsible for the Echelon system have access to only a very limited portion of cable and radio communications and can analyze only a limited portion of those communications. Regardless of the limitations of the Echelon system, the EU committee has urged the Parliament to encourage future development and greater use of open-source encryption technology by businesses and citizens in Europe. Emails can and should be encrypted by everyone, the report states. An unencrypted email message is like a letter without an envelope. The report also asks the EU Parliament to urge businesses to bolster their security and cooperate more closely with the intelligence and security services in Europe to uncover cases of industrial espionage. The entire working environment must be protected, thereby guaranteeing the security of a firm's premises, and checks must be carried out on persons entering offices and accessing computers, the report states. If security is to be taken seriously, only those operating systems should be used whose source code has been published and checked, since only then can it be determined with certainty what happens to the data. The report comes after several members of the European Union's Echelon Committee arrived in Washington on May 10th to conduct a fact-finding mission, only to be turned away by U.S. officials. Sources in Washington and Europe, however, said the committee members, including committee chairman Carlos Coelho of Portugal and David Lowe, head of the secretariat for the committee, arrived without an official invitation or scheduled meetings. They received no invitation at all, said an expert in Europe who has testified on the Echelon system before in the European Parliament. If you're not invited at the official level, you should not be surprised if nobody is willing to receive you. That's the official Bush administration view of what happened, said Lowe. But this is sort of splitting hairs, he said, adding that the U.S. officials pulled the plug on planned meetings only days before the committee members were scheduled to arrive. We did not wish to produce a report that contained a number of serious allegations unless they had an opportunity to comment, said Lowe. This was understood when I was in Washington in March, he said. We were rather disappointed that the opportunity was lost. As it stands now, the allegations in the report remain open. Since we're on the topic of rights, this next song seemed to be appropriate. This is The Clash. You're listening to Little Brother on WRPI Troy.
This is a public service announcement with guitar. Know your rights. Oh, three of them. Number one, you have the right. We'll be right back.
You're listening to WRPI Troy, where we believe in free speech, and we are dumb enough to actually try it. At any rate, if you want to try it with us, feel free. The phone number here is area code 518-276-6248, and I'm looking forward to hearing from you. Take a moment here for a public service announcement. Do you crave international travel? Do you have a genuine desire to learn about other cultures? If you do, Academic Year in America can give you an international experience right in your home. Academic Year in America, or AYA, is bringing students from Germany to more than 30 and more than 30 other countries to the U.S. this August and is looking for Troy families to welcome them into their home. These bright and motivated students will arrive with full medical insurance, their own spending money, and strong English skills, but best of all, they bring the customs, language, and history of another culture with them. You and your family can experience another culture without ever leaving your home. Troy families can host a student for 5 or 10 months. Parents with children or without, grandparents, single parents, and single-person households all make great host families. To qualify as a host family, you need to provide your host student with 2 meals a day and a place to sleep and study. But most importantly, you must have the desire to welcome an AYA international student into your family as if they were your own son or daughter. The decision to host will allow you to make an international student's dream come true while giving the gift of culture to yourself or your children, not to mention the students that you're bringing in. In addition to the tremendous rewards of hosting, Troy families can earn scholarship money to travel abroad or a travel voucher to visit their student in their home country. Don't miss this opportunity to make a difference in someone's life. Call Academic Year in America at 1-800-322-4678 if you're interested. That's 1-800-322-HOST. I'm sure they cannot wait to hear from you. And I can't wait to hear from you either, so why aren't the phones ringing? Give me a call, 518-276-6248. I'm willing to discuss just about anything about technology. So anyway, let's see what we have up next here. Microsoft's server software is easy to install, loaded with features, and fairly reliable. It may also be more costly to insure against hack attacks. J.S. Wurzler Underwriting Managers, one of the first companies to offer hacker insurance, has begun charging its clients 5 to 15% more if they use Microsoft's Windows NT software in their internet operations. Although several larger insurers said they won't increase their NT-related premiums, Wurzler's announcement indicates growing frustration with the ongoing discoveries of vulnerabilities in Microsoft's products. Some industry observers believe other insurers may follow Wurzler's lead, which could affect the overall hacker insurance market, a sector that the Insurance Information Institute estimates may generate $2.5 million in annual premiums by 2005. We saw that our NT-based clients were having more downtime due to hacking, said John Wurzler, founder and CEO of the Michigan company, which has been selling hacker insurance since 1998. Wurzler said the decision to change to higher premiums was not mandated by the syndicates affiliated with Lloyd's of London that underwrite his insurance that he sells. Instead, the move was based on findings from 400 security assessments that his firm has done on small and mid-sized business over the past 3 years. Wurzler found that system administrators working on open source systems tend to be rather better trained and stay with their employers longer than those at firms using Windows software, where turnover can exceed 33% a year. That turnover contributes to another problem. System administrators are not implementing all the patches that have been issued for Windows NT, Wurzler said. According to Microsoft's website, more than 50 vulnerabilities and the patches to fix them have been issued for Windows NT server software since June of 1998. Microsoft spokesman Jim Dessler said the hacker insurance market is still too young to declare Wurzler's move a trend. There's not enough of a history or business to draw conclusions about rate-setting practices, Dessler said. As the market matures, rates are likely to be based on the best practices rather than on platforms or products. We provide unparalleled support in the area of security, he said. American International Group, the country's largest insurance underwriter, said it will not raise its rates for the Windows NT-based systems, nor will Aon, the world's second-largest insurance broker. The use of NT is just one factor in the overall assessment of risks. It can be an indicator of other vulnerabilities, but you may have other things in place to counter that, like firewalls and intrusion detection systems, said Kevin Kalinick, a director in Aon's Technology and Telecommunications Group. Of course, I'm just going to jump in here and say that the point that Kevin Kalanick is missing is that firewalls are implemented on computers, on operating systems, and what are they running on? Windows NT also? Anyway, however, Harry Croydon, CEO of Safe Online, a London risk analysis firm that works with underwriters at Lloyd's, predicted that Wurzler's decision to charge more for Windows NT machines is a trend that we will see increasing, just as drivers who own race cars or rare cars are more likely to pay more to insure them. Certain types of software expose you to different risks. Although Wurzler's company is small, 8 employees, digital security firms are watching it closely. Bruce Schneier, Counterpane Internet's security co-founder and the chief technical officer, said it makes sense for underwriters to differentiate premiums based on the type of software and hardware that's used. Insurance companies are looking to manage their risk effectively. If there's a technology that reduces risk, they'll charge lower premiums, Schneier said. Indeed, several insurers offer discounts to clients that use managed security service providers or put certain security devices on their networks. For example, last week, AIG said it will cut premiums up to 10% for clients that use a new security device made by Invicta Networks, a Virginia company headed by Viktor Shamov and a former KGB agent. Invicta claims its device, which uses an internet protocol address-shifting technology, is impossible to hack. Well, I don't expect that claim will stand for too terribly long, but that's just me. Windows-based servers are frequently victimized by hackers. From August 1999 to November 2000, 56% of all the successful documented hack attacks occurred on systems using Microsoft server software, according to statistics posted at attrition.org, a website that records hackers' exploits. Given Windows NT's record, Gene Spafford, the director of Purdue University's Center for Education and Research in Information and Assurance in Security, believes that higher insurance premiums may be justified. He says, NT is more difficult to install correctly and keep up to date than Linux. Right now, it appears that Wurzler is going alone among insurers by charging higher premiums to Windows NT users, but Wurzler said the higher prices are not costing his company customers. A policy covering revenue lost due to hacking costs about $4,000 per year for each $1 million in coverage. About half of his clients use Windows NT, Wurzler said. The rest use Linux or some other flavor of Unix. Given that breakdown, he said it's easy to justify higher rates for NT machines. Why should a Unix player with a fewer vulnerabilities subsidize NT users, Wurzler said. And Wurzler's not through with Microsoft. He says his firm is looking at vulnerabilities in Microsoft's Internet Information Server software and that it may soon begin charging higher premiums for that product, too. So if you have an opinion about that, please give me a call. Area code 518-276-6248. If you know the words, sing along.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that the boat is leaking. Everybody knows the captain lied. Everybody got this broken feeling, like their father or their dog just died. Everybody talking to their pockets. Everybody wants
and the non-stem rose. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that you love me, baby. Everybody knows that you really do. Everybody knows that you've been faithful. Everybody knows you've been discreet, but there were so many people you just had to meet without your clothes. And everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. And everybody knows that it's now or never. Everybody knows. And everybody knows that you live forever. Oh, when you've done a line or two, everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. And everybody knows. Plague is coming. Everybody knows that it's moving fast. Everybody knows that the naked man and woman are just a shining artifact of the past. Everybody knows the scene is dead, but there's gonna be a meter on your bed that will disclose what everybody knows. And everybody knows that you're in trouble. Everybody knows what you've been through, from the bloody cross on top of Calvary to the beach in Malibu. Everybody knows it's coming upon. Take one last look at this sacred heart before it blows. And everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. That's how it goes. Oh, everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. That's how it goes.
That's Leonard Cohen from the Pump of the Volume soundtrack. Everybody knows. Well, I don't know if everybody knows necessarily, but I'll do my best to educate you and inform you. The Lawrence Journal World at www.ljworld.com reported on 22nd of May 2001 that Topeka, Kansas, population 122,000, and the capital city of Kansas, had suffered a water treatment plant outage due to a power failure on Sunday. A storm passed through the area and knocked out power to some parts of the city, including the part containing the water treatment plant. As a result, Topeka residents had to boil their water or buy bottled water, and drinking fountains across the city were turned off. The article quotes a Lawrence official who reassures the residents of the smaller city of Lawrence, that's population 80,000 or so, that such an event is much less likely to happen there, since it has two water treatment plants on nearly opposite sides of the city. And common theme that I've repeated over and over here, if you could call it over and over, actually, I haven't been here that long, but is that redundancy is a good thing. An Associated Press article dated 22nd of May says that Washington State's public school IT cooperative is spending $20 million on a new system from a company called Skyward that seems to raise more questions than it answers. Amongst other things, the students' grades and attendance data will now be available on the internet, and the system will supposedly also integrate such function as administration, accounting, and scheduling. Some pretty specious comments are being made regarding system security, such as, Skyward uses the same security measures that online retailers like Amazon.com use for their credit card purchases over the internet. The system also resists tampering because teachers continually revise the site. Securing a system like that is theoretically possible, but if the software itself is written well. But will security actually be implemented? Do the schools have the people who are knowledgeable enough to administer the systems without leaving gaping security holes? I kind of doubt it. And if the holes do pop up, the security could get pretty ugly. A lot of students will probably do their darndest to hack the system. I expect that in most schools, it won't turn out to be very hard, either by exploiting poor network configurations or just through basic social engineering to find a back door. The biggest problem I can see with this change, however, is that it's likely to become an attempt to replace a somewhat unwieldy but functional system, the current old technology interface between parents and the school officials, with one that has a totally different set of usage assumptions and failure modes, many of which will be confusing to anybody that wasn't involved in the production of the system. There's a strong possibility that schools adopting the new systems will try to switch over to using them exclusively, leaving technophobic or just plain unconnected parents out in the cold. There's a logic error common in technological industries these days that says that a new technology will make any similar older technology obsolete, but this rarely works out the way that the new tech evangelists think it will. In reality, new technologies tend to coexist with the old ones rather than replacing them. When this error was mentioned in response to yet another glowing futurist tech article predicting the death of CRTs, those are the cathode ray tubes, more commonly known as a picture tube, one of the author's colleagues astutely replied that it was true. He'd heard it this morning on the radio, which is kind of funny when you think about it. Anyway, I sincerely hope that the WSIPC gets things right here and that this effort isn't a washout. $20 million is a fairly large wager when you're playing technocraps. Note that the WSIPC headquarters is on Casino Road in Everett, Washington. Coincidence? I think not. And it's true what they say, that the technologies have a tendency to coexist. Sometime back, there was a guy by the name of David Sarnoff. He was the CEO for years of the Radio Corporation of America, better known as RCA. And he had somebody in his life that was sometimes a friend and sometimes a rival. And I can't think what the man's first name was. His last name was Armstrong. Armstrong is the man that invented FM radio. Up until that point, everything was AM. And Sarnoff was able to basically strong-arm FM radio completely off the market for years and years and years. There was actually used to be an FM band that was somewhere in the 40 megahertz range as opposed to the one that we have now, which is in the 88 to 108 megahertz range. That's what the numbers on your dial are. So the numbers went from, I guess, they were around 40 to 60 or so. And Sarnoff's belief was that television was going to put an end to radio. Well, here it is, some 70 years later or so, and I stand here in this studio proving him wrong. Not only that, but I'm doing so using Armstrong's invention, FM.
But
the thing of it is, Sarnoff was not completely wrong. AM is still alive and well as well. It's just kind of not quite as popular. Anyway, if you have your opinions, we'll use another old invention here, the telephone. Call me, area code 518-276-6248. Having fear of anti-globalization activists, the World Bank announced the cancellation of its 2001 annual bank conference on development economics, or the ABCDE. Oh, isn't that cool? In Europe, originally slated to be held in Barcelona on the 25th through the 27th of June. As Barcelona streets seem dangerous, they are planning to move the conference to a safest place that they can think of, the internet. In the news release, they say that fortunately, the internet means that academic debates can now take place online, and the plans are being made for an online discussion. McDonald's Corporation has begun testing the use of a cashless payment system that uses a kind of radio transponder technology that was first developed by state highways to allow motorists to drive through toll plazas without having to stop to make a payment. McDonald's customers will wave a small speed pass, which is a small transponder, at the drive-through window or at a device inside the restaurant, and their transaction amounts will be immediately deducted from a Freedom Pay account that they've established on the phone or over the internet backed by a major credit card. Similar systems have been used at mobile gas stations and some other fast food restaurant chains. Now, to ensure that nobody can forge the cards, I would imagine that they would use a very big MAC, that is a method authentication code, perhaps also serving as a mandatory access control. However, the MACs tend to be much weaker than the cryptographic checksums security-wise. Of course, in the spirit of fast food, if they're really in a hurry to pay for your meal with your speed pass and ingest it rapidly, you might phone ahead on your car phone to order your burger and fries in liquid form, a Big Mac shake with liquefied meat, cheese, and bun, and perhaps including your cold drink all in the same convenient takeout cup, which you could then wolf down one big gulp while driving and talking on your hands-free phone. It's understood, of course, that vegetarians in some places already have a beef with their fries, pun intended. And of course, I say that from the point of view of being a vegetarian myself. But given this new opportunity for ultra, ultra, ultra fast food, I think I'd rather just be fast. After all, speed with multiple meanings can often lead to arrest. Let's see what else we can dig up here. Bob Frankston wrote in to say that he's using Internet Explorer version 6.0, and it works pretty much like version 5.0 with a notable exception. UPS explicitly checks for it, and it doesn't let them use his service with an unapproved browser. Now, I'd assume I would think that it would be better for them to... Do they really feel that it's better for them to lose the customers than risk who knows what? There was a similar problem with IE4 going up to IE5, both with UPS and with Fleet Bank. Fleet paid a price for this because they were totally unprepared for Internet Explorer 5 when it shipped, and it took a few days to fix their bugs. UPS loses in two ways. First of all, they force their customers to use other services, and then they lose the value of users doing testing for them. They could warn you that they haven't tested with that particular browser, but disallowing it entirely is not only short-sighted, but it prevents presents a basic misunderstanding of the PC and the large effort put in to assure that compatibility with previous versions of programs is well in place. Now, old MIS departments, or sometimes they're called IT departments, did have a great fear of upgrades since each mainframe system was extensively patched, but that reasonable fear in this day and age is actually very definitely a phobia. Last time I was here, I spoke about how a document created in Word 97 could become two separate disjoint documents that are not even vaguely related to one another. Word was set to allow fast saves, which is a non-default setting that performs incremental rather than complete saves. It's a feature intended to speed the save operation. More information on FastSave can be found on the Microsoft Knowledge Base. The document was saved three times. The second save was to a different file name. Because the second save initiates a second pass over the document, Word was able to compress the Unicode, that's system of converting the individual symbols that you see on the screen to a series of binary numbers and back again, so that it was readable as ASCII characters and all incremental changes that were fast saved were collapsed. The first letter was then deleted, and the letter to Dr. Page was composed. A single save was then performed to a local non-network drive using the same file name. Because FastSave was enabled, the deleted text stream was identified, but not actually deleted. Because a single save is a single pass, and a Unicode compression requires a second pass, the text remained as uncompressed Unicode. Extra notes, documents on Microsoft's knowledge base contain a unique identifier indicating that the version was authored. The document in question contains a unique identifier indicating that the version it was authored on did not include the fix which removes that identifier. The document title under Properties is generated automatically from the first line of the document on the first save. It's not subsequently updated, so it may contain text that is no longer in the document. And for those of you who may not have tuned in last week, I'll tell you what the background is behind this. One of the contributors had a document that was mailed to him that contained a price quote on some equipment that he was buying. Now, the document was in Microsoft Word format, which works well for the vast majority of users, as the vast majority of users do use Microsoft operating systems. But in this particular case, this user was a Unix user, and Microsoft does not make a version of Word for Unix. As a consequence, he had to use some other utilities to try to extract the text, and when he did so, not only did he not find the price quote that he had asked for, but rather he had gotten an entirely different price quote that wasn't even directed to him and was for completely unrelated equipment to what he was ordering. Anyway, I'm going to take a short break here. You're listening to Little Brother on WRPI Troy.
She hustles onto the pain. But you can always return now, 'cause there's no need to give in to the strain.
You just got to believe.
So take me down to the river, take me down to the sea, to the land of healing, wings of love will carry me. I want to feel your arms around me of each moment that I breathe. Let your love surround me, bless my soul to sleep at ease.
Listening to WRPI Troy. That was Seven Nations, Our Day Will Come. And that's one of my favorite groups for some time now, Celtic rock band. Originally out of New York City, they moved down to Florida now and tour up and all up and down the East Coast. They were here last night, and that's what inspired me to bring that CD along. At any rate, I have to run this.
And now, the WRPI standard, universal, all-encompassing disclaimer.
Objects in radio may be closer than they appear.
Radio has been shown to cause cancer in laboratory animals.
Do not stare directly into radio.
In case of emergency, walk, do not run, to the nearest exit.
Warranty void if opened.
No user serviceable parts inside.
Do not dispose of in fire.
Allow 4 to 6 weeks for delivery.
Offer not valid in some states.
If rash persists, consult a physician.
May contain small parts, which could be a choking hazard to children. Alternate radio available for children 4 and under.
Do not taunt radio.
Caution, radio under pressure. Do not puncture.
You may make copies for archival purposes only.
Prolonged exposure may cause permanent hearing loss.
Warning, pastry may be hot when heated.
Your radio is not a substitute for professional medical advice.
What you're about to hear does not necessarily reflect the views of the staff and management of WRPI, the Rensselaer Student Union, or the administration or trustees of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute.
And what you are listening to is Little Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and the topic is technology. I did get a couple of calls during the break there. One was bashful, one was busy for work, however. Busy getting ready to go to work, that is. However, if you're not bashful and you're not busy, please give me a call. The number here is area code 518-276-6248. And I don't bite, really. Anyway, the Register is reporting on French swimming pools at the Centre Sportif Richard Bozon. It seems that instead of a simple and traditional bolt on the doors to the changing cubicles, the center has installed a computerized array of motion sensors which detect if the cubicle is occupied and displays a red or a green light to indicate occupation. Now, there's nothing to prevent somebody from ignoring the lights and opening an occupied cubicle. The obvious flaws were pointed out by the Register, including the problem for colorblind people and the sheer stupidity of putting in a high-tech solution to a low-tech problem. But they miss other problems, such as the false positives and false negatives, and the requirement to train users of the facility in the meaning of the lights. Another article off of the Register from 28th of May basically says, in short, describes an investigation by the UK Linux User magazine. It was found that the certificates being used on parts of gateway.gov.uk, The UK government's attempt at making all services available online by 2005 are specific to Windows and Internet Explorer 5.01. These signatures are currently provided by Equifax and Chambersign. The article also goes on to say that the government gateway doesn't exactly have much on it at the moment, but the likelihood is that although simple registration by username and password will give you access to some information services, all the transactional ones require the use of certificates. The one service available for individuals, electronic filing of tax returns, certainly does. So, effectively, only Windows and Internet Explorer users can currently use it. UK.gov seems to have swallowed the Microsoft pitch whole. According to Linux user, the explanation given is that other browsers do not give proper support for SSL and digital certificates. I, for one, am very concerned. With Microsoft-based servers apparently being hacked almost at will, I can see a future where it will no longer be possible, just be the internet where your identity can be used. And just for variety, what about if you're one of these people, albeit in the minority, that uses a non-Microsoft operating system or even not Intel hardware, such as a Macintosh or Unix of some variety? And of course, these folks that put this article together are using a Unix of some variety. Of course, until the original Linux user article appears, none of this could be really collaborated. Has anybody else noticed the cluelessness of Microsoft's marketing when assigning a name to their new line of products? Do you think any of these marketing people are familiar with the popular emoticons or smileys? Has anybody else realized that XP is a person wincing and sticking out their tongue? Will the new Microsoft products leave a bad taste in your mouth? And that, of course, is a passing reference to the new Microsoft operating system that's supposed to come out. I think it's supposed to come out this year, although knowing how Microsoft is with schedules, it may not come out for several more, called Windows XP. And the emoticons are... The most common one you see is the smiley, where you type a colon, a dash, a closed parenthesis, and when you look at it by turning your head sideways, you see a smile. And many word processors and email and chat room clients will actually convert that into a smile, which is kind of a cool feature. But XP is somebody wincing and sticking their tongue out. I really can't think of anything more appropriate for a Microsoft product. If the history of the 20th century was marked by bloody struggles against totalitarianism, then the history of the 21st will likely be marked by efforts to curtail the excessive corporate power that grips the United States and is spreading throughout the world. This conflict between morality and prosperity isn't only about the survival of individualism, it's about the soul of technology which created the fast food nation. It could soon be the story of computing, too. Technology, as futurists like George Orwell and Arthur Clarke have been predicting for decades, will be the battleground in which the fight against corporatism is played out. The United States has become a corporate republic, with the takeover of cyberspace one of the republic's primary goals. Corporate domination of the real world no longer seems possible unless companies like Microsoft and AOL Time Warner bring the virtual one under control. From sweetheart regulatory legislation for media companies and telecoms to the Children's Internet Protection Act to Carnivore and the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, they're working on it. Small entrepreneurs are falling like flies, just as late diners, family eateries, and small farm and market packers have, small farms and meat packers have fallen before McDonald's and Burger King. In fact, technology and fast food profoundly intertwined serve as useful metaphors for unintended consequences that accompany scientific advances. Fast food is, in many ways, the story of contemporary America. Its work and health, its homogenization, fast food is central to urban and suburban sprawl, and to the rise of malls as retailing forces. Fast food has created the generation of new, mostly lousy jobs, cemented the divisors between the rich and the poor, triggered an epidemic of obesity, and sparked resentment of America's so-called cultural imperialism abroad. It's the stepchild of post-war progress in farming, slaughtering, and packing, refrigeration, and transportation. For a preview of the unintended ways in which technology shapes the new world, ways nobody wants to think or talk much about, the fast food industry is a good and sobering case study. Fast food practices are already shaping tech industries too, from computing to software to biotech. A case study is exactly what Eric Schlosser provides in his new book, Fast Food Nation. In the 1970s, he reminds us that political activists were already warning about the McDonaldization of America in much the same way that hackers, programmers, and open source advocates are sounding the alarm about the Microsofting of the Internet. Those activists sensed that the emerging fast food business threatened independent companies and presaged a food economy dominated by giant corporations. Beyond that, fast food franchises obliterated a sense of geographical and cultural differences among different regions of the United States. The appeal of fast food, that people would know just what to expect no matter where they bought their Whoppers or Taco Bell burritos, was also one of its most devastating consequences. And there were plenty of others. The industry was one of the first to use technology, especially advances in genetics, to set the ground rules for the corporate republic, whose media, culture, and economy are increasingly dominated by McDonald's-esque notions about uniformity, scale, and work. The fast food biz reconceived the high-tech manual labor factory. It has always relied on poorly paid workers doing regimented, robot-like work. It has naturally attracted a disproportionate number of immigrant, poor, and minority workers who have little real chance of advancement and whose work is so rote and mechanized that they have no need for high wages, further training, or the opportunities to acquire meaningful new skills. The corporatized industry has, with the help of equally corporatized media, portrayed itself as a great boon to the underclass, hiring people nobody else would employ. The fast food industry also perfected, even nationalized, the notion of false courtesy, those forced mumbled greetings and thanks delivered with all of the sincerity of a telemarketer that echoes to this day throughout the tech support and customer service universe. The burger, pizza, and burrito chain's vast purchasing power, writes Schlosser, and their demand for an uncompromisingly uniform product have triggered fundamental changes in farming and how cattle are raised, slaughtered, and processed into burgers. These changes have made meatpacking, once a highly skilled, well-paid trade, into the most dangerous job in the U.S. performed by legions of poor, transient immigrants whose rapidly rising rate of injuries attract little publicity or government attention. The same meat industry practices, reports Schlosser, have facilitated the introduction of deadly pathogens such as E. coli into America's hamburgers, one of the foods most aggressively marketed to kids. Schlosser describes how the natural flavor of most foods, what consumers crave when they order burgers and fries, are liquids manufactured in flavor companies along the New Jersey Turnpike and in the Rust Belt. The American flavor industry now has annual revenues of about $1.4 billion, reports Schlosser. Until 1950s, flavor additives were usually used mainly in baked goods, candies, and sodas, but the invention of gas chromatographs and mass spectrometers, technologies that could detect volatile gases at low levels, radically increased the number of flavors that could be synthesized. Within a decade, the American flavor industry was creating the taste of products from Hamburger Helper to Pop-Tarts. The evolution of the fast food industry shows us not only how powerful and ill-considered technology is as a force in the American life, but offers some chilling previews of where the net, the web, the computing industry, and tech culture may be headed. The lessons of fast food have been learned all too well and deployed enthusiastically in the so-called new global economy. Computer chips are also made in faraway factories. These jobs pay more than the average wages in some countries, but they're still lousy jobs, generally making pennies. Assembly and packaging jobs pay even less. Like the people who established burger chains, the net's founders arose from a ferociously individualistic culture. Advances in technology generally provided by diverse and idiosyncratic subcultures, from hackers and geeks to researchers and entrepreneurs. but an industry launched by iconoclasts with bad haircuts in garages and basements has become a global one based on rooting out the individual creativity and promoting uniformity. The net is already being overwhelmed by mass-marketed sex, entertainment, and retailing entities, and the tech industry is already notorious for creating thousands of low-paying, unrewarding, dead-end jobs. It's promoting American notions of culture all over the world. Just wait until the ethos that brought you the natural flavor in McDonald's gets a hold of AI research and the Human Genome Project and starts making perfect, sweet-tempered babies to an unsuspecting world. Mary Shelley's Frankenstein warned about the unthinking application of technology all the way back in 1803. Technology made the fast food industry possible, and without any real national discussion and consideration, retailing, health, work, and the ability of individuals to operate farms or small businesses was altered for good. As Eric Schlosser thoughtfully points out in his book, there was nothing preordained about the corporatization of food and culture. From the airline industry to computer companies, American corporations have always worked to survive under Darwinian laws of the marketplace by eliminating or absorbing their rivals, the heart of the Microsoft strategy, in fact. Some tend to see this corporatization as something apart from civics or public policy, but it isn't. These companies ought to be accountable. Taxpayers helped create them. Some of the strongest growth areas of the American economy, the computer, software, aerospace, and satellite industries, have been inspired or subsidized by the federal government. The net, the heart of the so-called new economy, began, of course, as the ARPANET, the military communications network funded by Congress in the late 1970s. Free markets are good for economies and, in many cases, for the people who work in them. They can promote creativity, innovation, prosperity, choice, and individualism more than other political and economic systems. But there has to be a balance between the prosperity of the market and the morality of the market, a balance already tilting off-center in almost the entire range of tech industries and on the net and on the web. The relentless corporatization of retailing, farming, publishing, and entertainment, to name only a few, have swung the balance much too far, at least in the United States. Corporations are now the primary contributors to the American election system. They fund the overwhelming majority of lobbyists who prey on Washington. They block regulation that would promote competition, offer the public more choices in areas like internet access, and fend off governmental and other supervision. They promote conformity and uniformity. Since the corporations have acquired virtually all of the popular media, they are rarely criticized or challenged. Schlosser writes, an economic system promising freedom has too often become a means of denying it, and the narrow dictates of the market gain precedence over more important democratic values. This ought to sound familiar. The same economic system promising security, morality, freedom, protection from artists and the, protection for artists and the owners of intellectual property is using technology to transform the net with the same zeal that hamburger chains used to decimate family restaurants. The story of fast food is turning out to be our story as well. And I actually wanted to take a moment to say a word or two more about that particular article. Well, again, I'm going to use myself as an example. Here I stand in a studio of an independent, a truly independent radio station. As you flip up and down the dial, you're going to hear music in a number of different formats. Put your dial on the same position at the same time, or even at a different time later on in the week. You'll hear the same kind of music. May even be very difficult to differentiate what song. If, for that matter, it may even be the same song. I used to make a joke about being able to set your watch by the song that's playing on the on one of the local radio stations, which shall remain nameless. But as you scan up and down the dial, you're presented what appears to be a choice. But the fact of the matter is, just a handful of large corporations own the vast majority of the radio stations that you will hear. We're down here at the bottom of the FM dial, which somehow back when the FM dial was established, the FCC had the incredible foresight to say any station at or below a certain frequency. And it's been tossed around here at the station as to exactly what that frequency is. It's something around mid-91 to 92. But any station at or below that particular frequency has to be non-commercial in nature. Now, as time's gone by, they have managed to alter the exact meaning of non-commercial. As an example, there's a station a couple channels down below us, which will also remain nameless. But actually, a couple stations, a couple channels down below us, accept a concept called underwriting. And as I mentioned in a show many months ago, what happens is, as soon as you hear the message, "This program brought to you by Acme Widget Corporation, the best widgets in the world, www.acmewidget.com. That's corporate influence. Do you think that anybody at such a station that is carrying this message, this, by the way, commercial message for Acme Widget Corporation, is going to speak out against Acme Widget Corporation? No, they're not going to. And the reason they're not going to is because they've been told not to. And the reason they've been told not to is because the station management doesn't want to lose the funding from Acme Widget Corporation. So what happens is you get all of these miscellaneous public broadcasting entities, which in fact are not public. The corporations control them too. As for the rest of the dial and the AM dial, I think there are three companies in the Capital District that own most, if not all, of the commercial AM and FM radio stations that broadcast to this area. One of them doesn't even make any excuses or apologies for it. You go to the location of their studios, and sitting outside, it says the name of the company and lists off the seven radio stations in the Capital District. That's right, they own seven of them, including the single largest one. Lists off all seven of the radio stations that they own. That particular company owns approximately 1,200 radio stations nationwide. So, folks, you need people like us. With that in mind, I'm going to take another moment break here. If you want to throw in your 2 cents worth, please do. Although it'll probably cost you a quarter. The phone number here, area code 518-276-6248. Song about corporate control.
Get off the air! How far will you go? How low will you stoop?
Okay, you are listening to WRPI Troy. And by the way, we did get another phone call during that break. Our signal tonight is going out pretty good. We're getting all the way up into Vermont, which is excellent. So if you're out there listening and you're in an area where the reception is a little bit fringy or a little bit less than optimal, we'll just say. You can also pick us up on the web. We're at www.wrpi.org, and there is a real audio feed off of there, 12 kilobit per second real audio feed. Not the greatest sound quality in the world, but it'll give you something to listen to if the FM is too noisy to hear. So once again, it's a case of the high technology and the low technology coexisting, which is a wonderful thing. Anyway, next item I have here, let's see. After a team of academics who broke a music watermarking scheme bowed to legal threats from the recording industry and chose not to publish their research in April, they vowed to fight another day in another way. On Wednesday, Ed Filton of Princeton University and seven other researchers took their fight to a New Jersey federal court in a lawsuit asking that they be permitted to disclose their work at a security conference this summer. Joining them is the USENIX Association, a 26-year-old professional organization that has accepted Filton's paper for its 10th Security Symposium in Washington during the week of August 13th. The Electronic Frontier Foundation is representing the researchers and USENIX. In what appears to be the first legal challenge to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act's criminal sections, USENIX is asking the courts to block the Justice Department from prosecuting the conference organizers for allowing the paper to be presented. And for those of you who don't recall what that was about, I'm not sure where I want to begin here. Actually, we'll take several steps back. Some months ago, there was a... all right. For some time, there's been some discussion by the record companies and such that they wish to develop some sort of a system by which they can track where a particular copy of a song came from. And the system that they want to use is called digital watermarking. And basically, what you're doing is you're hiding some data in the music. The data doesn't theoretically affect the sound quality in any way, although I imagine in practice somebody would probably notice some degradation. And there are some people with some really, really sharp ears out there. I've been accused of such things myself. I don't think I am, but I digress. The idea is that they want to embed a serial number into the sound of every song on every CD so that it's possible to tell when something gets passed around, say, for example, by Napster or some similar mechanism. It's possible to trace that back, trace a trail back to where that song originally came from, presumably with the intent of ultimately coming after the owner of the original CD. Now, exactly what they're going to do once they find that person, I don't know, or how they're going to find that person, I don't know exactly, because obviously if you, in order to track it down to an individual person, you're going to have to register at the record store every time you buy a CD, and I don't think people would stand for that for very long. At any rate, the serial number is to be embedded in every song, on every track, on every CD, and this gives a sort of a, an audit trail that can be followed to try to track down where a copy that showed up on the internet came from. At any rate, some development work was done, and they did figure out a couple of different mechanisms to do this, and collectively they are called the SDMI, that is the Secure Digital Music Initiative. And what they did several months back is they set up what was called the Hack SDMI Challenge. You sign on with them. You sign some legal paperwork, basically agreeing that you will not reveal what you did to anybody but SDMI. And you go at it and you try to break the code. This is basically what they wanted to do to test the code and find out if the mechanisms that they've come up with are any good. If it's possible to break them, to erase the serial numbers from a track, to change the serial number to something else, or to, in some cases, ignore the serial code or put a false one in. Well, I already mentioned changing the serial code, so I guess that qualifies in that under that category. But these particular researchers elected not to accept the prize money that was being offered by SDMI. They took the samples that they got from SDMI, and they wrote a legitimate academic paper on how the encryption system works. They did legitimate research. They wrote a legitimate academic paper. They were preparing to present this legitimate academic paper at a legitimate academic gathering. And they were sued. That, to me, sounds like a prime example of an infringement against the freedom of speech. Freedom of speech in this country is something that we should be able to enjoy. And I'm seeing more and more often there are cases like this cropping up, which are making it difficult, if not impossible, to speak your mind. We here at WRPI, however, are not afraid to speak our minds. And we hope you're not either. 518-276-6248 is the number here if you would like to speak your mind. It's actually been rather unusually quiet this evening. I gather it's probably got something to do with the fine weather that we've been having today. Anyway, Phil Ager writes an article in which he says he was driving on I-405 northbound in southern Los Angeles County when he saw a bitmapped billboard on the east side of the road that was displaying a Windows error message. He said he could not make out the exact text, but it was something like, "The file cannot be played. It may be corrupt." This was a first, he says. He'd seen Windows error messages displayed on video monitors in airports and in other public places, but never on a full-sized billboard. Now, digital billboards that display animation are already a risk of distraction to passing drivers. There's an especially bright billboard on the Sunset Strip, which, in his humble opinion, is a serious traffic hazard. And it often plays music videos and the like. He says, I don't know what the billboard on I-405 normally shows. One might argue that the giant windows error is actually an anti-risk, because it reminds the entire populace of just how unreliable Microsoft products are, thus reducing the likelihood that a passing motorist will specify such products as part of a safety-critical system once they get to work. On the other hand, it's easy to imagine the havoc that could be caused by someone who managed to hack a billboard next to the freeway and display their own content on it, particularly if the billboard is supposed to display safety-relevant traffic messages. We have a little more information on the Microsoft Word changing the content of a message. This was submitted by Daniel P.B. Smith. He says, if you send a Word document file directly to somebody else without going to the track changes and accepting all changes, your recipient can see all of the edits that you have made to the document with results that can be humorous, embarrassing, or worse. And this is old news to my listeners, but I believe I mentioned this, several times before, but perhaps the most recent appearance of an article about it in the Wall Street Journal is worthy of mention. The article is entitled, How to Read Between the Corporate Lines. It gives the procedure for viewing Microsoft Word edits and, with somewhat less clarity, the procedure you must go through to prevent somebody else from viewing your edits. The way the journal puts it, just a couple of clicks provides a revealing peek into how some companies massage their public messages to Wall Street. In a news release from Ameritrade Holding Company, in one draft, Ameritrade billed the March hiring of a Mr. Moglia as one of the right decisions the company made during a difficult second quarter. But his name ended up on the cutting room floor, a thin blue line erasing him from the final version. It mentions that analysts and investors looking for an earlier draft would have found a per-share quarterly loss of 31 cents, but that too was crossed off to change to a loss of 30 cents. An Ameritrade spokeswoman brushed it off, saying that it's too bad, but on the other side of it, it's too bad that someone would think to turn the edits on. The article goes on to cite minor gaffes from Visa USA, Allied Capital, WebStreet, and Axiom, leaving little doubt that the problem is widespread. There are no real howlers or scandals here, but you'd think that the risks would be obvious, wouldn't you? And actually, I do have a comment on this one as well. Useful bit of technical information is that if you do use one of these products that does keep the all of the edited information in there, one absolute way, as far as I know, to make sure that the edited out content does not stay in the document would be to save your document as an RTF file. That would be a rich text format. You're going to lose some of your fancier formatting information if you do this. However, I think that that should take a definite backseat to your security. Okay, we have an interesting one here. This one's a little more upbeat. This one was out of Technology Review, was written by Alan Leo. He says that data hidden in the flicker of fluorescent bulbs may help the disabled lead independent lives. The flicker of fluorescent bulbs, long a symbol of institutional drear, may give new freedom to the handicapped thanks to a high-tech startup that sees the bulbs as the perfect transmitters. Talking Lights, a Cambridge-based MIT spinoff, is developing a local area network that uses fluctuations in fluorescent lights to transmit data. The inventor, company founder, and MIT professor Stephen Leeb predicts that the technology will be a boon for the disabled. For example, he says airport lights could direct a blind person carrying a special receiver worn as a badge or held like a PDA to the correct gate. Auditorium lights could broadcast enhanced audio to the hearing disabled or transcriptions to the deaf. And research published this month suggests that the technology could greatly improve the rehabilitation of persons with traumatic brain injury. In his MIT laboratory, Leeb recently demonstrated his invention. First, he turned on a circular fluorescent light. "See," he said, "a normal lamp. You probably have one in your bathroom." Next, he picked up his receiver, a black box attached to two small speakers, and from a few feet away, he pointed the receiver at the lamp. Music blared from the speakers. Tinny but clear came the familiar chorus from Handel's Messiah. At the heart of the device is a new kind of ballast. That's the component of a fluorescent light that regulates the amount of electricity flowing into the lamp. Magnetic ballasts dim the lamp nearly every 1/20th of a second, the normal oscillation of alternating current, causing an imperceptible flicker. Newer electronic ballasts speed up the flicker rate to milliseconds, eliminating eye strain and hum, two complaints long associated with fluorescent lights. Since electronic ballasts flicker independently of the current's oscillation, Leeb realized that they could, with some modification, encode data. He designed ballasts that transmit both digital data by turning the light on and off in short bursts and analog data by modulating the light's brightness by degrees. A basic Leeb-designed ballast can encode a simple repeating signal such as the location of an emergency exit. A more advanced version includes a modem to read data transmitted over the power line. Fluorescent transmitters offer two advantages over radio systems like Bluetooth, says Talking Like CEO Neil Lupton. The first, he says, is price. A building can retrofit the company's ballasts to existing fixtures for incrementally more than high-efficiency electronic ballasts, which cost between $15 and $25 retail. Second, unlike Bluetooth's current design, fluorescent transmitters can be geographically isolated, transmitting location information for different parts of the same room. Once Leeb figured out how to transmit information via fluorescent lights, he racked his brain for applications. Realizing its potential as an assistive technology, he contacted Harvard Medical School. David Burke, director of the Brain Surgery Unit at Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital in Boston, responded. Each year, Burke says, as many as 2 million Americans suffer traumatic brain injury, mostly from car accidents, falls, and violence. Although physically capable of caring for themselves, people with severe brain injuries often lack the cognitive and memory skills to manage their daily lives. Many require constant monitoring, a labor-intensive solution costly in terms of both money and the patient's independence. Burke and Leeb designed a system to remind brain-injured patients at Spalding about their schedule. Each participating patient carried a personal locator and minder, a modified PDA, programmed with the patient's schedule. Lights in the patient's rooms, hallways, and certain other areas were set up to broadcast location information to the personal locator. When the time of a scheduled event, such as a therapy or a medication, drew near, the personal locator would remind the patient. Using location information from the lights, the personal locator would judge whether the patient was proceeding towards the event and give more detailed directions if needed. The results of the study are published in June's Journal of Head Trauma Rehabilitation. Patients got to their destinations earlier and with less human prompting. There was a significant reduction in the need for staff to direct patients towards their therapies, wrote the researchers, with the added benefit of increased efficiency of the arrival. These results should be interpreted as preliminary, but are rather exciting in their import. Another benefit, Burke said, is that the system could help people with Alzheimer's disease and early-stage dementia lead more interesting lives. In August, a second study will test the system in greater detail. This time, the researchers will give every patient in the brain injury unit, a handheld device and retrofit every bulb in the unit in related therapy areas. That study will give researchers a better idea of which patients benefit mostly from the system, Burke says. Leeb envisions far more applications for his invention. Malls could direct the blind and the befuddled alike. Airlines could turn their planes' cabin lights into a data network without adding miles of wire. Fluorescent lights are everywhere, he says. The infrastructure is already in place. station is WRPI Troy. The show is Little Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter. This is kind of an interesting one. Because as I was saying before, I was talking before about the problems there are with radio. And as frequent listeners to this station are already well aware, there are a number of problems going on with a station in New York City. That would be WBAI, where they are having, they're having some issues involving a corporate takeover, or what appears to be one. WBAI used to be an independent station, very much the way we are, except they didn't even have an academic master to answer to. They answered only to their listeners. And some recent management decisions have really annoyed a lot of the listeners, to say the least. One of the changes that has recently taken place is basically they have stopped broadcasting Democracy Now! Over their own airwaves, instead only feeding it out as a satellite feed. Democracy Now! Is an award-winning news program, and very hard-hitting. It's very deserving of all of the awards that it has received. If you want to hear it for yourself, actually, you can. It can be heard on these airwaves every Monday through Friday at 9 o'clock. At any rate, this is a press release that I found on 2600.com. On Monday, 18 irate listeners to non-commercial radio station WBAI 99.5 FM marched into the station chanting, "Take back WBAI and restore progressive radio." Several interrupted WBAI's morning show, demanding a reversal of the sharp rightward political turn and selective censorship of the programming, as well as an end to the attacks on workers' rights. Some protesters attempted to hang a 30-foot banner reading "Save Progressive Radio" from the 10th floor studio at 120 Wall Street, while other members of the group distributed flyers with their demands to a very surprised staff. I don't know why they're surprised. WBAI is a public radio station and a listener-sponsored Pacifica radio network, which consists of this station and four others in Berkeley, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and Houston. The nonviolent group calling itself Loud Rap, that stands for Listeners Outraged, Upset, and Determined to Restore a Progressive Pacifica, which organized the protest, insisted that the programming at the Pacifica Network return to its progressive founding mission. The group demanded that WBAI interim station manager Utrice Lead schedule within 2 weeks a two-hour on-air program hosted by the station's local advisory board to discuss the crisis at WBAI and Pacifica. The program would also allow both sides to present, including representatives of WBAI management staff and listeners. The group also demanded the resignation of Ms. Lead and a reversal of what they called the purge of leftist programs and programmers undertaken by her since her installation by the increasingly corporate-led National Board of Pacifica in a late-night coup on December 22, 2000. According to Miguel Maldonado, a listener activist and also the chair of WBAI's local advisory board, since the coup, Ms. Lead has removed or preempted some of the most progressive, critical, and popular radio programs on the air, replacing them with bland, new age material, and in the past month, at least three programs based on ultra right wing anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. One of the programs currently preempted in New York is Democracy Now!, an award-winning daily news program showcasing voices of dissent. In addition, Ms. Lead has fired or removed 21 producers and staff members, imposed selective on-air censorship, and is trying to impose a new labor contract that removes all unpaid producers who comprise the vast majority of programmers from legal protection. For more than 41 years, WBAI has been New York's cherished outlet for progressive issues and community concerns rarely heard in the mainstream media. Today's action is part of a rising crescendo. This would be Monday's action. A rising crescendo of criticism of the current management, including a very effective listener-led boycott of WBAI's current three-week on-air fund drive, on which the station depends for 85% of its revenue. Got contact information on that also. If you're interested, you can contact Mark Sanborn at area code 212 803-8231. The station is WRPI 91.5 Troy. The show is Little Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter. The topic is technology. The number is 518-276-6248. This is an item that was found in the Wall Street Journal. Microsoft's Windows XP operating system, due to be released October 25th, is designed to be easier and more reliable than previous home versions of Windows, but Microsoft has another agenda for Windows XP. The program is also designed to be a platform from which the company can seamlessly offer the users an array of new subscription services via the internet. One key test of the Windows XP will be whether its features do more to benefit consumers or Microsoft's business plan. Another will be whether the operating system favors Microsoft services over those of other companies. The company has said its software won't discriminate against others selling web-based services. I've heard that one before. But even though Windows XP is still in development, I've already encountered one proposed feature, a beta or test version, that shows Microsoft may well flunk both these tests. The feature, which hasn't yet been made public, allows Microsoft's Internet Explorer web browser, included in Windows XP, to turn any word on any website into a link to Microsoft's own websites and services, or to any other sites that Microsoft favors. In effect, Microsoft will be able, through the browser, to re-edit anybody's site without the owner's knowledge or permission in a way that tempts users to leave and go to a Microsoft-chosen site, whether or not that site offers better information. The feature, called Internet Explorer Smart Tags, wasn't in the widely distributed second public beta of Windows XP issued in March, and it isn't easy to find, even in later builds that have had much more limited distribution. In response to my questions, Microsoft officials stressed that the feature may still undergo modifications to make it more palatable, but they defended it as a useful tool. Smart tags represent another step in personalizing the web and helping bring it to life for individuals by allowing them to get information they want in the way they want it, says Chris Jones, Vice President of Windows XP Development. Here's how the Internet Explorer Smart Tags work. On a PC with Windows XP, when you open any web page, squiggly purple lines instantly appear under certain types of words. In the version I tested, these browser-generated underlines appear underneath the names of companies, sports teams, and colleges, but other types of terms could be highlighted in future versions. If you place your cursor on the underlined word, an icon appears, and if you click on the icon, a small window opens to display links to the site, offering more information. For instance, in the new browser, a Washington Post article on Japanese baseball players was littered with 8 Microsoft-generated links that the Post editors never placed on their site. In the beta version I tested, most of these links weren't functional yet, but Microsoft's officials confirmed that they will send users to the Microsoft web properties or to other properties blessed by Microsoft. One of the links did work. It launched Microsoft's mediocre search engine, which is packed with plugs for other Microsoft services. One Microsoft official says the feature will spare users from underlinked sites, but who decides if a site is underlinked? It's up to a site's creators to decide how many and which terms to turn into links, where those links should appear, and where they should send users. It's part of the editorial process. In the case of the Washington Post article, the editors included plenty of links, but chose to list them at the bottom of the article and in a box on the side of the text. Microsoft decided otherwise. Microsoft says the Internet Explorer Smart Tags feature, which is similar to a Smart Tag feature in new Office XP, will be turned off by default in the final release, and that users will have to consciously choose to enable it by activating a set buried in the browser's menus. In addition, Microsoft says it will provide a free bit of programming code called a meta tag that site owners could use to bar any Smart Tags from appearing on their sites. But if the feature is so benign, why is Microsoft hiding it and offering other sites a way to block it? Microsoft also says that other companies besides itself will be able to create and distribute add-ons for the browser that will launch their own Smart Tags all over the web, directing users to their sites. But these tags will be far harder to obtain than Microsoft's, and they will merely allow more companies to invasively re-edit other people's sites. Ford would be able to impose its own links on Chevrolet's site, and Republicans could insert links on the Democrats' sites. Once the hate groups, the spammers, and the junk marketers on the web get their hands on these Smart Tags, they'll be plastering links on everything. There have been some excellent third-party programs like GuruNet, now Atomica, that let users click on words within a web page to get more information, but these don't place new links on pagers, and they aren't built into the browser that more than 80% of the web visitors use. Microsoft's Internet Explorer Smart Tags are something new and dangerous. They mean the company that controls the web browser is using that power to actually alter others' websites to its own advantage. Microsoft has a perfect right to sell services, but by using its dominant software to do so, it will be tilting the playing field and threatening editorial integrity. Listening to 91.5 FM WRPI Troy. My name is Chuck Ritter, the show's little brother. And we're just about out of here. DJ Toast is in the house, and he's setting up. So you should hear from him in probably about 5 minutes. Anyway, that last article, since it kind of upsets the flow of web pages to the end user, I just thought I would throw this next song out to offer a few words of encouragement. This is The Folk Implosion on WRPI Troy.
Nothing's gonna stop you.
You're listening to 91.5 FM WRPI Troy. And that's it. I'm out of here.